Hi friends, it's your girl E, and this is The Call, where we hear from wildly inspiring and interesting women about their journey to answer their life's calling. You know what time it is, right? La-da-da, dancing in September, la-da-da. Yes, it is September, the absolute best month of the year. And no, I'm not just saying that because it's my birthday month, although please mark your calendars for September 13th. I don't know, September just feels good. It has good energy. It feels like new backpacks and fresh notebooks and back to school time. You know, people are back from vacation. It's just time to lock in and recommit. It's like a fresh start. You can recommit to what you want to do and who you want to be for the rest of the year. And I usually use the time to look back at the first 8 months of the year and see who I've been and what I've already done. So for me, 2018 was very, very focused on self. A lot of my goals, my ambitions, my personal growth, and that's all good and well. There's a time and a place for that. But an unfortunate side effect is that it means I haven't been using my time or my voice in service of others as much as I usually do and as much as I believe is important to do. I know I'm not alone. It's so easy right now in this time when we're all just struggling to keep our heads above water and then fighting for the injustices that we feel personally impacted by. It's easy to forget how important it is to stand up for others and how connected we all are. My dear friend Rebecca Coakley has been such an influence in my life in that regard, teaching me and reminding me what it means to fight against injustice no matter where it shows up and to be an ally to communities that I may not be a part of. To wake up every single day asking, who can I serve and who can I fight for today? Rebecca is the director of the Disability Justice Initiative at the Center for American Progress. You'll hear us call it CAP in our conversation because I used to work there and it's shorthand. But her work there now focuses on disability policy. We actually talk about some of that policy right at the top of the conversation. We kind of jump straight in talking about it and the political climate because there's so much at stake right now. And also, you know, that's my former life. So once a policy wonk, always a policy wonk. There'll probably be some things that you'll want to Google. But we don't spend all of our time there. We get it pretty quickly into talking about her amazing career. Rebecca worked for the Obama administration and oversaw diversity and inclusion efforts for the White House. And Rebecca doesn't just talk about these rights. She understands them personally. She herself is disabled. She's a little person. But that's not what makes her special, at least not to me. It's her heart and her sense of purpose. Rebecca's known since she was a child that she wanted to fight for the rights of others and those in her community. Just wait till you hear her story. And I think of her story and her mother's story all connected. So wait till you hear their story. We dig into that. We talk about how working at Victoria's Secret prepared her for the White House. How growing up in the AIDS epidemic in the 80s really, really shaped her life. Why she didn't end up going to law school and how joy is a super important part of survival. She also shares some heartbreaking moments, ways that people with disability are still being treated, or should I say mistreated today. And then she shares the things that, in spite of all of that, keep her going, keep her motivated and driven for the cause. I left our conversation, as I do every conversation with her, fired up and ready to serve even more and to make sure that I remember all the ways that our struggles and our lives are connected. So anyway, I hope you leave this interview smarter, more compassionate, and more committed to the idea that everyone deserves someone to show up and stand up for them. Here's my dear friend, Rebecca Coakley, on The Call. Rebecca, thank you for being on The Call.
Thank you so much, Erica. I'm thrilled to be here today.
I am so, so happy. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting to get you on. And this is a perfect time. We just passed, maybe back in July, the 28th anniversary of the ADA.
Yep, 28 years now.
And for those who don't know, ADA is the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I've always thought of it as being something that had been around for such a long time.
I know. And it really is one of those things that it cracks me up that even 28 years after it's passed, we are still continuing to have to sort of keep the fight at the gates from folks who want to decimate it. And as I've been telling folks across the communities, the continued assault on public accommodations for marginalized communities is the same, whether it be the attacks on the ADA, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, the Muslim ban, the wall. You know, we continue to see this administration chip away at literally the access to society for those of us that they don't see fit to walk amongst them, I guess.
It's so interesting for us to jump in right there, because when I talk about you, which I do often, I tell people, you know, you and I met doing civil rights work. I was at a leadership conference on civil rights, which is now a leadership conference on civil and human rights, a name change. But we were doing civil rights work in D.C., and I thought, you know, I was young and somewhat arrogant at the time, and I thought I knew everything there was to know about civil rights, kind of civil rights activism and advocacy, and I was always talking about race and always talking about gender, and I thought I was fancy because at the time I was like, and I'm also talking about sexual orientation. And I never, ever, ever talked about, even thought about people with disabilities until I met you and heard kind of your advocacy and your work. And I said, wow, there's been this whole kind of aspect of the fight for civil rights and frankly for human rights that I had been, you know, completely oblivious to. And I think a lot of people feel that way. So even hearing you kind of rattle off these policies and talk about ADA, I imagine a lot of my listeners are saying, like, wow, I'm hearing a lot about immigration right now. I'm hearing a lot about, you know, kind of race and gender. I'm not hearing as much about the attacks on civil rights and civil liberties and human rights for people with disabilities. Why is that?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One, I think it's important to note that the disability community exists across all communities. The latest data that we saw come out of the Centers for Disease Control about 2 weeks ago upped the number from 1 in 5 to 1 in 4 people in this country are people with disabilities. And I think there's a couple of reasons why we don't traditionally include the disability community with the broader civil rights folks. I think one of it is traditionally we always just think about it as, frankly, white dudes in wheelchairs. We're not talking about disabilities and diseases that are specific to communities, things like sickle cell anemia. We're not talking often about people with postpartum depression. We don't often talk about people with chronic illness, things like lupus, fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue. We don't often talk about mental illnesses. We don't talk about eating disorders. We don't talk about, you know, people who are cancer survivors often. And all of these communities are actually part of the 57 million people with disabilities. The other thing I think is important to note is that there isn't a single issue today, whether it be the immigration fight. That's a great example. Right now we're seeing and continuing to hear rumors that the Trump administration is going to put out what they're calling a public charge on immigration, which if it actually happens, what that will mean is if you're a person wanting to immigrate to the United States or a person here who wants to become a citizen and you or any of your loved ones has ever been on any public assistance program, including nutrition programs, including Medicaid, including lighting and heating assistance, among many, many other programs, you will be ineligible to become a citizen, and you may even end up being deported. You know, and so that's a case where there definitely is a disability lens to the immigration issue. You know, as we continue to push back on rampant police violence against communities of color, we know that the data roughly tells us that 50% of individuals killed or assaulted by law enforcement are also people with disabilities. You know, and so as we continue to sort of navigate all these different fronts in the civil rights space, I think it's really critical in terms of building solidarity and also building the fortitude to move forward, that we really delve into who is actively being affected and how do we bring those voices to the table in these fights.
So then I want to talk about the who. You, right? I want to talk about who and your voice. So tell me how you grew up, because I know so much of your childhood shapes what you do today.
Oh, definitely. You know, I grew up in the Bay Area. Both my parents were little people, which is common in my community, but rare in the broader disability community. Roughly 80% of people with disabilities grew up in families where they're the only people like them. And so I grew up in a very close-knit family. Both my parents were little, but both of them came from all average height families. Growing up in the Bay Area, my dad ran a Center for Independent Living, which is a center that is focused on helping people with disabilities be able to live independently, getting the services that they need, being able to access their rights, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And my mom ran a disabled student center at a community college. And growing up in the Bay Area in the 1980s, and seeing the literal immersion of AIDS, mm-hmm. and how it decimated the lives of so many friends and loved ones that we had, seeing it in terms of the people that were coming to my dad's center to get services, to try to access healthcare, to fight back on employment discrimination in the days before the ADA was there. Mm-hmm. And watched so many of my mom's students who literally would come to her office and say, my parents are ashamed of me because I have AIDS and I don't want to die without leaving them a college degree.
Wow.
And can you help me at least get a degree? I don't care if it's in underwater basket weaving. I don't care if it's in liberal studies. I just want to leave them with something so that they'll have something to be proud of me for. And really seeing that firsthand. And, you know, it was always sort of that those values of interdependence and focusing on meeting the needs or centering the needs of those most impacted was something that my mom's family very much cared about.
Mm-hmm.
My dad's family were sort of different. My father's father was an ultra conservative segregationist federal judge from Selma, Alabama.
Wow.
Who put Congressman Lewis in jail enough times that there's significant literature on him in the congressman's autobiographies.
Wow.
And the congressman and I live in the same neighborhood now here in Capitol Hill, and we often joke about it because when he first met my son Jackson, he said, "Oh, this is Judge Hare's great grandson." And I laughed and I said, "Yes, sir, it is." And he said, "Wow, you know, Judge Hare's great grandson is a biracial little person." He's like, "That is proof of the arc of justice right there. There's some evidence right there."
That's amazing.
You know, and my dad was very, very different from his parents, mm-hmm, in terms of his values and wanted to make sure that I was raised in such a way that I was cognizant that, you know, my liberation was literally tied up with the liberation of other people.
Mm.
And we had to be on the front lines to fight because, as we all know, if you're not at the table, you are most definitely on the menu.
I remember reading the story about you were talking about growing up in that moment when so many of your mother's students and family friends and, you know, were literally dying of AIDS, and you would go to these funerals and there would be sometimes few people there. And there's this quote you said that your mother would tell you when you asked, like, "Why are we here?" Do you remember what that was?
That we have to be here because nobody deserves to die alone, and everybody deserves a death with dignity, and to have people there to remember them. Yes,
I love that. I paraphrased it and wrote it, and I have it sticky on my computer. And the way I read it was, "We're here because no one deserves to have no one stand for them." And it's just,
yeah,
it's so powerful, and I think it clearly shapes what you do today. But did you always know that that was your journey? So you grew up in this environment. Was it clear then that, like, that's what I'm doing for a living?
When I was really young, I wanted to be a civil rights attorney. That was my focus. And I think there were a couple of reasons for it. One, my mom, my parents separated. And my mom ended up going back to school. And my dad actually left us because my mom got accepted into college to go back to school.
Wow.
And she was taking night classes and working full time to support her and I. And so I would spend evenings at my grandparents' house, who lived about 6 blocks away from us. And on Thursday nights, L.A. Law was on. And my grandma would let me stay up late to watch L.A. Law because my mom would usually get home around a little after 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I will admit, I totally had a huge raging crush on Jimmy Smith. my mom thought I was watching it because at the time there was a little person actor on there playing a civil rights attorney.
No.
Who was based on a family friend, Paul Stephen Miller, who went on to serve as the longest serving commissioner over at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And so my mom was very much like, "Oh, we'll be totally supportive of this. You get to stay up late because here's like one of the first positive portrayals, totally non-exploitative, of a little person on television," mm-hmm, "played by a little person. This is really great." She didn't realize that it was totally because I had a huge raging crush on Jimmy Smith. And so growing up, I really did want to go into civil rights law. And that was honestly going to be the focus until, you know, I went to college. I went to University of California, Santa Cruz, home of the Fighting Banana Slugs.
Yay.
Greatest mascot available. and then started prepping for the LSAT and could not get through the logic games piece. I tried everything under the sun. I did the big class tutoring. I did one-on-one tutoring. I did the you know, electric tutoring. Nothing worked for me. And so I ended up taking a few years off and split my time between working for Victoria's Secret in San Francisco and working for Congressman Tom Lantos, who was the only member of Congress who was a survivor of the Holocaust.
Wow. Wow.
In the Bay Area, and did that for about three or four years.
Splitting your time between that and Victoria's Secret.
Yeah. You know, hey, and honestly, the two things really did feed into each other, because if you've ever worked retail, you know how to talk to just about anybody mm-hmm. about just about anything. Mm-hmm. And you have to make them spend money on the most mundane things that they might think they don't have any need for, but you have to make them really want it. And I feel like that's public policy work on a daily basis here.
That's the best connection and analogy. I love that.
You know, and then I ended up coming to D.C. to work at a nonprofit where I worked for a number of years working on education issues of young people with disabilities, which is actually where I was when I met you.
Yeah.
And then after when President Obama founded his campaign, it was the first presidential campaign in history to have a disability policy committee.
Was it?
And I talked my way onto it by scaring my elders by asking them who was managing their social media.
Oh, yes. Pull the young people card.
Totally pull the young person card. And they were like, oh, my God, we don't understand any of this. We don't even understand how BarackObama.com works. Please fix it for us. And so I did that. And then after the election was won, that same friend and family friend, Paul Miller, ended up working at the White House in presidential personnel and called me and brought me over first to work at the Department of Ed for a year and then to serve as the chief diversity officer for the administration.
I mean, talk about a perfect path, even though it's so funny because like when you tell the story or when it's on paper, it seems like, yes, it was so clear. You knew what you were going to do. You ended up doing it. And then, you know, voila, you're working for the president of the United States. But I also love that there were these kind of little moments in there where, like, you thought you were going to go to law school. And it was just that did not work. And it didn't pan out how you thought it was going to. Right. And then you're working in a congressman's office, but also working at Victoria's Secret. There are these pieces that I think when we tell stories about our career trajectory, oftentimes folks leave out. They leave out the things that don't sound so perfect and so pretty and straightforward. But it's beautiful how that contributed to the end game and to where you really ultimately were supposed to be.
Oh, definitely. I mean, had I gone to law school at that point in time, I would have missed the chance to work in the Obama administration.
Wow.
It wouldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think about the amount of outreach we did. I think about, you know, being responsible. And really, I mean, I think my time in the administration really sort of honed my skill around being an ally. And I think a lot of times people underestimate the actual tangible work of allyship.
Mm-hmm.
And having, you know, having to be trusted to be the liaison to the African-American community for personnel issues as a 4'2" redheaded little person, you know, and having to develop that trust, nurture that trust, and build that trust across not only the African-American community, the Latino community, the LGBT community, women, veterans, recent college grads, the disability community, and really having to communicate the commitment to create an administration that reflected the diversity of America. And then also at the same time, to push back on those communities when they weren't giving us what we needed, whether it be pushing back on communities of color that were sending us candidates that did not reflect the LGBT community or that did mm-hmm. not reflect women.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to push back on my own community, on the disability community, for a lackluster outreach to race and ethnic communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and so taking the time to not only recreate what an administration looks like, but really push our constituencies to do better by the people that actually make them up.
And you sit at the intersection of several of those communities yourself, right? Like your husband is African-American
yep.
and average height.
Yep. My husband, we have a lovely interracial, interspatial marriage. you know, he's I actually don't even know how tall he is. It's funny. We're coming up on 10 years and I'm just like, he's average height. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know height.
That's enough. They're just average.
All tall people look alike to me. And so he's 5 foot something. And then we have three kids. Our older two, who are 7 and 4, are both little people. And our youngest, who is 5 months, is average height.
Baby Kendrick.
Baby Kendrick, yes.
So you wrote this piece. You know, I think one of the headings in it was about even parenthood as a person with disabilities being mm-hmm. being activism or advocacy, because it's so there's so many obstacles in terms of cultural perception, cultural norms, standards and expectations that push against that. You talked about even this to me was a horrifying story about what happened as you were giving birth to, I believe it was your second child, right?
Yeah, it was when I had Kaya,
right.
Yep.
You want to tell us about that?
Sure. So I was going in for my second C-section, and I was literally lying on the metal table. And this was, mind you, after my OB had pried my BlackBerry from my fingers, because this is right in the middle of preparing for the government shutdown in 2013.
Oh, my gosh.
And had been through the C-section. Kaya was out in the bassinet next to Patrick and I. And over my shoulder is the anesthesiologist, who I had not gotten off to a good head start with, just mainly because I found him completely dismissive of any feedback I had given mm-hmm. him. And he says to my OB, who's down sort of by my knees on the other side of the shielding that they put up when you have a C-section, and he says, "So while you're down there, are you going to tie her tubes?" And my OB looks at me, who is a very strong, very brilliant, very amazing Black woman, looks at me and sort of like gives me the eye, and I give her the eye back. And she was like, "Hell no, what are you even talking
about?
And
why would you even ask that?"
And like, "Why would you even ask that?" And I'm like, "I'm sitting right here too. You could ask me."
Oh my goodness.
And he was like, "Well, you don't need to have any more kids after this."
That's crazy.
And, you know, and my husband, I'm the very fired up one in our relationship. I always
no,
say that my husband's
really?
The nice one. and I watch my husband's just, like, back get rigid. And he, like, turns and looks at the guy and is like, "You can stop now." Mm. And my OB was like, "Do I need to request another anesthesiologist to come in for the wrap up? Because you are clearly out of line, sir." And it just sort of blew me away that, you know, I think... there, you know, and we've seen Serena Williams even talk about there are very few times
yeah.
in your life that you're more vulnerable as a woman than with your OB and in an OB related situation. And to have somebody completely dismiss your right to bodily autonomy, to have somebody think they know better than you, to have it be a man, in my case, an able-bodied man, mm-hmm. Just sort of blew my mind. And it was one of those moments where I can, you know, it just sort of strengthened my resolve that it was like, no, you know, this is an issue. And the rights of people with disabilities, rights of all people,
right.
But particularly marginalized communities that are often dismissed when voicing opposition to things or trying to exert self-advocacy or self-determination, you know, it doesn't stop in the office at 5 o'clock.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's real life.
Yeah.
How did you learn? Because you called yourself fiery, which I think is an understatement, and why I love you. How did you learn to speak up for yourself, right? To be, you know, aggressive and strong and clear about who you are, what you deserve, what is okay, what isn't okay. Consent. I read a piece where you were talking about the idea of, you know, folks come around little people and assume, or all people with disabilities, and assume they don't have that right to kind of their own space, and they touch and pull and pat. I mean, when did you learn? Was it as a child? Was there like a formative experience when you kind of realized, I have to speak up for myself?
I grew up very lucky. I had, you know, like I said, my parents were activists, so it sort of was embedded in my DNA. But I also grew up in a school district that was extremely supportive. I'm actually Facebook friends with my elementary school principal, and talk to him quite frequently online, which is kind of amazing. But for me, having the realization that that wasn't the reality for a lot of my friends mm-hmm. was really powerful. We had a friend who, when I was in junior high school, and he was in elementary school, my mom got a call, and he was a little person, but he grew up in a family with all average height siblings and parents. And his mom called my mom because he was on his way. He was supposed to be home from school one day, and he didn't come home after school. So his mom assumed that he had gone to Boy Scouts. And so then texted the scoutmaster, and the scoutmaster was like, "No, he didn't come to Scouts." And so at this point, the sons come down, and they're concerned because their youngest of three children isn't home. So they send, you know, the parents stay home, but send out the older two siblings who are both in high school to go look for our friend Vaughn. And they end up finding him at the school, at his elementary school. He had been beaten up and thrown in the dumpster and was so short he couldn't get out of the dumpster, and he couldn't get up high enough to voice the lid up.
Oh, my gosh.
And so they get him home, and, you know, his mom calls the principal, and the principal's like, "Yeah, you know, we thought it was weird that he wasn't in class after lunch, but, you know, whatever."
What?
And I remember Vaughn's mom saying, "But nobody went to look for him. Nobody, you know, he hadn't been at the nurse's station. He hadn't been sent home. Like, nobody cared. Nobody noticed." And so the next day when Vaughn went to school, he took one of those little like 11-inch little wooden baseball bats that you get as like a promo at a baseball stadium. Mm-hmm. He had it in his backpack to protect himself and was expelled for harboring a weapon.
Oh, my gosh.
And his mom called my mom and said, because at the time my mom was still working at a community college, but still doing broader ADA advocacy work. And Cherie called my mom. And so my mom actually pulled me out of school that day and said, we're going to drive over to this other school district. We're going to go see Vaughn and his family. And she's like, you get to stay home with Vaughn, but I have to go in and help Cherie deal with the school. Mm-hmm. And she told me what had happened. And it just blew my mind that was the reality for kids like me.
Yeah.
That not every kid with a disability went to a school where they were fully integrated, that bullying wasn't tolerated, that they were supported in their desires and their learning, in their socialization. And I remember my mom coming home after going into to battle with the principal and saying, and us being in the car driving back home across the bay, and my mom saying, you know, what blew me away was that the principal's justification for the other kids' behavior was that boys would be boys and that Vaughn better get used to it because that's what the rest of his life has in store for him.
Oh, my gosh.
And, I mean, he was in, like, fourth grade when that happened.
Wow.
And it just, I mean, as a kid, it just completely enraged me. It was like, how is this okay? How is it okay for, you know, me to go to my school with no problems, fully supported, loving educational environment, great teachers that I'm still friends with today, and that to be okay for, you know, less than an hour away from us, that's what's happening to a friend who has the exact same disability I have and has the exact same needs that I have.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and I think really from that point on, it was just like, no, somebody has to be there to continue to fight back. And, you know, I think if I were to point out any sort of point in my life where you know, sort of that fixed point in your timeline where your course was starting to be set, it was definitely that point.
Do you get tired now, though? Because I feel like
every day,
right? Like I hear these stories and I'm like, we're in a moment now when these rights are under attack again, or maybe I should say still, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you've been doing this work for so long. So many people, I mean, you stand on the shoulders of giants in terms of the length of time and the amount of work and blood, sweat, and tears that has been put into fighting for rights for generations. And yet here we are. And not to be, you know, negative or pessimistic about
yeah.
it, but I'm curious because, I mean, you were in the belly of the beast, right? I got out of Washington. You are the...
We miss you every day, though.
You know, I miss you. I do not miss that environment because it can be so draining, right?
Yeah.
What do you do? What is your kind of personal process or rituals that help you get up every morning and say, no, I'm still fighting this good fight, and I'm doing it with joy, right? And not, I'm doing it with positivity and hope.
Well, it's funny that you actually use the word joy. So right after the election, I had a meeting when I was running the National Council on Disability. I had a meeting with Congressman Lewis's staff. And the congressman ended up being there for the meeting. And I remember asking him, I was like, okay, sir, if anyone's going to know how we get through this, it's you. Mm-hmm. You have literally been through it all. What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do we keep moving on? How do we keep fighting? How do we keep striving for that model of good trouble that you talk about?
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, he said, one of the most important pieces of resistance is joy.
Mm.
And he said, there's nothing the other side hates more than to see us joyful, than to see us celebrating, than to see us working together on common things. He's like, they thrive off of anger and divisiveness and hatred. And if we can keep finding reasons to smile, reasons to laugh, if we can keep finding community and fellowship across all of our spaces, across all of the communities that we represent, then we'll find ways to sustain ourselves.
Mm.
You know, and I think that personal and movement sustainability piece has been a really big thing. And I've been really pleased to see folks actively talking across communities about things like self-care. I kind of joke about it because the disability community has been talking about self-care for literal almost a century.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I'm like, oh, activists, the progressives have discovered self-care. That's so cute. Right. Like, yay for Columbusing self-care. Y'all just go for it. But I think one of the things that's been really powerful, and it was interesting, I had a conversation with Brittany Packnett about this a few weeks ago, is actively talking about mental health in times like this. Mm-hmm. I think if we look back to the 60s, you know, and what sort of came out of that period of time, so many folks were struggling in the work. Like, we come to this work, we come to movement work because of trauma across communities, mm-hmm. whether it be racial injustice, whether it be marginalization because of LGBT status or immigrant status, because we're disabled, because of whatever other reason we may be looked at as deviant or not fitting in. And I think that figuring out the sustainability piece really is tied into mental health. And so how are we sustaining our mental health? Because if we talk to our elders, they'll tell us. They have so many friends. And we've seen it when even our generation, if you look at activists from Ferguson, if you look at activists from Ohio, activists from the Bay, et cetera, we have seen an increase in suicides. Mm-hmm. We have seen an increase in overdoses. And really having a real conversation that movement sustainability has to be centered on individual sustainability. Mm-hmm. And talking about mental health and talking about where do we find joy? Like, where do we find the reasons to keep moving forward?
Right. Right.
And for me, a lot of it is in conversations like this. For me, there is nothing more important than cross-movement solidarity. Mm-hmm. And figuring out how we approach the fight for our literal collective liberation across all of our communities.
Yeah.
You know, we've been doing all kinds of fun work with little lobbyists. And traditionally, the adult disability community and the parents of kids with disabilities community have not always had the strongest of collaboration.
Oh, interesting.
You know, it's typical. I mean, parents and adults, like, you will butt heads. But in watching the folks, people like Elena Hung and Marta Connor and others that are in those spaces that see adults with disabilities not as enemies, but as critical parts of their children's future, but see us as, like, having those moments where I realize that I am the elder in the community.
Right.
For kids like Xiomara, who's Elena Hung's daughter, who's my daughter's age, who's 4, I'm always going to be like her mom's old friend that has been doing this work for forever.
Right.
And spending time engaging with the kids, engaging with the parents, understanding that the parents' perceptions of their children's disabilities mm-hmm. are going to be ultimately shaped by their perceptions of what we do.
I'm so curious. You talked about kids, which is funny because when I was thinking about what brings me joy, some of that is watching videos of your kids on Facebook. That brings me joy. And kids in general. I'm so curious, like, how being a mother has impacted and shaped not just your work, but your life. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an element of that that I imagine is kind of perspective. But I'm also really curious, just from the standpoint of being a working mother and being a woman, you know, who is so hardworking. And I mean, you literally were putting your BlackBerry down as you were going into a C-section. You know, how has motherhood shaped or impacted the amount you work, how you work, and how you approach your work?
Honestly, it was one of the main reasons I came to CAP. So when I left the day after the election, I pulled out the GSA pay schedule, which is the pay schedule in the federal government that tells you when you're going to get paid and how your vacation accrues. And I realized that I would have 10 weeks of paid vacation on July 7th mm-hmm. of 2017. And so I called my boss the day after the election, and my boss was located in New Hampshire because I worked for a board chairman. And I said, okay, July 7th is my last day. And he was like, why July 7th? And I'm like, because at that point, I will be 2 months ahead in our mortgage. I can get us to 2 months ahead in our mortgage. Mm-hmm. I can have the summer to play with the kids, and I'll have 10 weeks of vacation leave that I can just veg and watch Law and Order marathons or, like, catch up on, like, the stack of comic books I've had next to my bed that I haven't read yet. Uh-huh. And for me, that was a big thing, was figuring out the most responsible time to make a completely irresponsible decision.
Yes.
You know, and I left without a plan in mind. I just knew that I had been working for the Obama administration literally from lights on to lights off. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't had a summer vacation since high school. Wow. And so taking some time to take stock and figure out what I wanted to do. And I was actually going to take a job in the disability rights community at a disability-led centered organization. And a friend of mine, my boss here, Rebecca Vallis, who's the vice president of our poverty team, called me and said, hey, can we meet for drinks? And I said, yeah, sure. And she was like, I know you're getting ready to accept this job. Don't accept it. Come work for us at CAP. Mm-hmm. And the running joke was that I've always changed jobs in the middle of pregnancies, which is
like... Have you really?
Yeah. I went to the White House pregnant with Jackson. I went to the National Council on Disability from the Department of Health and Human Services pregnant with Kaya. And I left NCD and came to CAP pregnant with Kendrick. And it's one of those things that you always get told not to, like, it's the nightmare scenario.
I was going to say, that sounds very scary to me.
Oh, it was completely terrifying. But having a boss like Rebecca, who was like, no, we're going to make this work. And, you know, we want you here. We are launching this. You know, we want to launch a disability center. She came here several years ago and came here under the auspices of not only getting the poverty shop up and running, but also building out a criminal justice team and then a disability team. And the CJ team was nurtured up and spun off and is its own team now. And she was ready to do the same thing around disability. And, you know, and she was a dear, was and still is a very dear friend. And it was one of those things where I said, I was like, but Vallis, you know, I'm like hugely pregnant. And she's like, yeah, so whatever. She's like, we'll figure out how to make it work.
Oh, that's how it should be. I wish all women could have that experience.
I felt so spoiled and so indulged. And being at an organization that really, yeah, I mean, there have been numerous times in the last, since Kendrick was born 6 months ago, that the kids have, that Jackson or Kaya or Kendrick or some combination of the three of them have had to come into work with me and then train up the entire team on playing The Floor is Lava. You know, or the hokey pokey or some other exercise, you know, it has been amazing. You know, and I'm also at the same time also going to say, like, it's not easy. It is extremely hard. And, you know, I would be foolish to ignore sort of the privilege that I come to this space from. Mm-hmm. You know, I know a lot of working women that don't have the supports that I have. You know, I have a spouse who is completely amazing and works really hard and puts up with a lot. I have kids that are as comfortable going to receptions after work as they are going to playgrounds. Mm-hmm. Jackson actually recently just created a folder on my phone of all of the pictures of him in front of organizational logos and backdrops.
Stop it.
Because he was like, here I am at the leadership conference. Here I am at the Congressional Black Caucus. Here I am at the Center for American Progress over the years.
Hilarious.
And I was like, and I said to him, I was like, I just found this folder. And he was like, yeah. And it was just called signs. And he's like, those big signs that I stand in front of when we go to things.
Oh.
I just thought it would be neat to have a folder of all of my pictures in front of those big signs.
I love that.
You know, and I think part of it for me is really also talking to them about why we do what we do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, right after the election, my son, we picked him up from school. He was in kindergarten. And, you know, he had gone to bed thinking that Hillary was still likely going to win. And, you know, woke up the next morning, we told him what had happened. He was pretty upset. And he goes to a very diverse public school here in D.C. And when we picked him up that day, he got in the back of the minivan. He looked at me and his dad and was like, all right, guys, mom and dad, I have a plan.
Oh.
And we're like, you what? And he's like, we have a plan. And I said, okay, well, what's the plan? And he said, well, we wrote a list of all the kids in the class that have basements. And I was like, everybody that has a basement? Oh, okay, why? And he was like, because, and he goes to a Spanish language immersion school.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of the Spanish teachers are immigrants.
Oh.
And he was like, if we need to hide our teachers, we need to know where we can hide them.
Oh my gosh.
And there's also a couple of trans kids in his class. And he said, and we know that they're going to come after trans kids. And so if we need to hide them, we know where we can hide them too, and we can just move them around. And so this is literally the kindergartners figuring out the Underground Railroad at recess.
Right. And I'm like, it's funny. I went through so many emotions here in that story because, you know, obviously that's the context of that is devastating.
Yeah.
That they're even having to think about this. And yet I was smiling a little bit because I'm like, you got a little activist.
Oh, he's totally a little activist. They both of the older two are. But it was like one of those moments where it was like, I'm very proud that you're thinking about this.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very proud that you're thinking outside of yourself and how this is going to impact people that you love and care about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I said, and at the same time, you know, and I went sort of back to that classic Mr. Rogers quote about looking for the helpers. I was like, and at the same time, remember, Jackson, there are all kinds of adults here who are fighting too, who are fighting with us. And let's think about who we know, who else that's fighting. You know, and so he was able to talk about, I mean, he talked about Uncle Wade, you
Wade.
Know.
For those who don't know, Wade Henderson, my former boss who ran the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights, legendary civil rights advocate, like just a mentor to so many of us.
Icon. I mean, Wade is one of those trees in the community that has sprouted so many fruits in terms of all of us in our activism. And, you know, I really credit, I mean, I wouldn't know you, Erica, if it wasn't for Wade.
Nope, same.
I think, you know, being able to point to Wade, being able to point to like Mara Kiesling from the National Center for Transgender Equality, you know, and other folks that we know and saying, you know, we're all in this fight together. I'm glad that you all are fired up. And that's great. Mm-hmm. Please let us know. I'm thrilled that you're telling me your plans. Please keep us informed of your plans going forward, because the last thing we need to do is come home and find a whole bunch of folks sitting in our basement without... You know, anybody giving us a heads up. But like having these conversations and the fact that, you know, this was a kindergarten class having this conversation, you know, and so I think really, you know, talking to our kids about it, but at the same time also letting them still really helping them focus on still being kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In times like this.
It's so interesting just to think about even, so, you know, mentioning Wade and Mara and then thinking about you and me and kind of the different ways our work has played out over the years, and then thinking all the way down to your kids, just kind of looking at how the fight for justice and equality evolves and changes and morphs and goes through different phases and seasons with different generations, but the principles and the values remain the same.
Oh, totally. I mean, when I was over at the leadership conferences last week, hanging out with our mutual dear friend, Tyler Lewis, and we were like, are we really in another SCOTUS fight? And we had this moment where we were talking about social media activism and what we were hearing from a lot of the young people that we engage with. And we were like, you realize that now? I'm like, now we're the old guard.
That's crazy.
And, you know, we've been doing, you know, most of us have been doing this work 20 years now.
Oh, my gosh.
And... The view is different, and there's a lot to be offered. And at the same time, like thinking about what privilege comes with, you know, being the old guard now, and how we, you know, I always share your video, Erica, from the State of the Black Union.
Oh yeah, my Tab is Smiley video.
That is easily, I share that video at least a half a dozen times a year with young activists.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Because to me, You're speaking truth to power in that point where you were talking about how after the election, you were hearing from the elders that they wanted you to go back and organize some more.
Yeah.
And you using the reference of, you know, how about instead of buying you some shoes, I teach you how to make some shoes.
Right.
And I always think about that point, and it's such an important point in terms of the importance of us aging up in our activism to make way for those that are coming behind us.
Mm-hmm.
And learning for good and bad, like being able to depart the lessons that we've learned through our own sort of leadership DNA over the years.
So what advice would you have for someone now? I mean, most of my listeners are in, you know, 20s and 30s, kind of our age range, and are pursuing careers that they're passionate about or trying to pursue careers that they're passionate about. But I think that, you know, one of the premises of this show was answering that greater call on your life, no matter what your career is, whether you consider yourself a full-time activist or not, whether you're working in, you know, media, tech, fashion, medicine, whatever it is, if you have a, you know, a 9-to-5 job, but you still feel that there is a call on your life to do something that has even deeper meaning and deeper impact. What advice would you give to that person?
Do something where you're respected, where you're expected to bring your whole self to the table, and where that's celebrated. I have a colleague who does immigration work, and one of the things that he had told me recently was he was very out about the fact that he has been in recovery for 20 years, and would talk about that in his immigration organizing all the time. And in a conversation, you know, in latter conversations, I found out that he also had a mental health disability. And I said to him, I was like, so, you know, when I hear you speak, you're very out and proud about, you know, your 20 years in recovery, and you use that as a key part of your story. And I said, you know, why don't you talk about the fact that you have anxiety? And he looked at me and he's like, honestly, because I've never thought about it as a strength. And so I said to him, I was like, I was like, here's a challenge. I was like, I had a colleague challenge me to talk about my disabilities other than my dwarfism several years ago. And I said, you know, I want to challenge you to do the same thing. I was like, your next big speech, I want to challenge you to disclose your anxiety if you feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. I was like, because, you know, nobody should be outed without their consent for anything, but just try it. I'd be very curious what the response is. And he did. And as he got off the stage, he was mobbed by like 50 young immigration activists who all had mental health disabilities. Some of them that were congenital, they were born with, that they had always had, some of which that they had acquired through their own trauma, through whether it was movement work or their personal, you know, their personal lives, et cetera. But they had always felt that they had to leave that part of themselves out of the game, that they had to lock that part of themselves up, that it was something to be shameful for. And I think so many of us have parts of our lives that we feel like we have let society convince us that they were deficits and they really were strengths. And thinking about how we bring them to the table and how they enrich, like you said about my path, how my path, you know, linearly looks really looks totally normal and mundane now, but like, you know, the time with Victoria's Secret and working for Congress, you know, the time thinking I was going to go to law school, the time thinking I was going to go work for a disability rights organization and chose to come here instead. You know, there is nothing about your path that you should be ashamed of. And there really isn't one path. But to be successful, I really think it's about embracing all those pieces of yourself and not holding it back and working in a space that allows you to celebrate all those different parts of yourself.
That might be my favorite. I hear a lot of advice on this show. That might be one of my favorite pieces of advice because it's so important. And look, everyone does not have the privilege of having, you know, a job where they can bring all parts of themselves into it. But I think the advice was broader than just your job. The advice was, you know, make sure that in some space in your life, you can be your whole self. You know, I know there have been periods where I've gone through times where there, you know, I couldn't do that or I didn't prioritize doing that. And it takes a toll. It takes a toll when you're, you know, when you are feel like you're spliced and diced into 10 different people all day long. And here you have to be one way. And here you can show this part of yourself and not that part. And not having any space where you can just bring all of you the good and the things that other people have told you aren't good. I won't even say the good and the bad. I'll say the good and the things that other people have told you aren't good all to the table. I think that's really, really, really important and a great way not just to answer your call and find your right career or your mission, but just to be a whole person.
Definitely, definitely.
Rebecca, thank you. Thank you so, so much. Not just for this call and this interview and just for being a great friend, but also for the work that you do. It's so, so vitally important. And you do it well.
Thank you, Erica. We miss you out here.
I know. I keep saying I may come back. I still can't. I can't do that during the Trump years.
No, I feel you on that. The town is a very strange place now.
Yeah, but I'm glad you're still there.
I told you would end up feeling a little smarter, a little more inspired. I don't lie, y'all. Thanks to Rebecca for being on the show. If you want to find out more about her, her work, and generally stay in the know around all sorts of justice issues and issues related to the disability community specifically, make sure to follow her on Twitter at Rebecca Coakley, C-O-K-E-L-Y. This episode was produced by Melody Rao and published, as always, by Man Repeller. We have two more episodes left this season. We're winding down. Man, the season flew by. If you've been loving what you've been hearing, make sure to leave a comment on Apple Podcasts, tell your friends, and of course, hit me up at Miss E. Will on IG or Created by Erica on Twitter. I'm your hostess with the mostest E, and until next week, y'all know what to do. Keep loving, keep fighting, keep dreaming, and above all, keep answering your call. Peace, y'all. Calling.